From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. As President Trump kicks off another round of trade tariffs on Chinese imports and China responds in kind, there is some good news today on the jobs front in this country. The U.S. economy added 213,000 jobs in the month of June, according to the latest jobs report out this morning from the Labor Department. The unemployment rate ticked up to 4% from 3.8% in May. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News and joins us now to talk about this. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So the number of new jobs in June is higher than expected, 213,000. What does this say about the economy right now?
Well, it is just another sign that the economy is still humming along pretty nicely. And if you look inside the guts of the report, where a lot of the job growth is very encouraging, it was in sectors like business and professional services added 50,000 jobs and manufacturing added 36,000 jobs. But one of the really important numbers in this is the average hourly earnings growth. In other words, how much people's wages are rising. Mm-hmm. And it was 2.7% year over year, which it might not sound that great to get only a 2.7% raise, but it is on the high end of what we've seen over the last decade, but not quite high enough that it would make economists worry that the economy is overheating and that things like inflation and interest rates would have to come up as a result.
But with prices going up on some things, that 2.7% might not be enough to make up
right.
for that.
Exactly.
Gas
exactly.
prices have probably gone up by more than 2.7% in the last year. Why is the unemployment rate ticking up when the jobs numbers are so good?
Well, it's basically because more people have entered or re-entered the workforce after being on the sidelines for a while, not looking for a job because they were either discouraged or pursuing education, that sort of thing. So it's what's known as the labor force participation rate increased to 62.9%. And it's another sign that the economy can continue to add jobs without necessarily stoking very strong inflation, which would be a worrying thing to economists.
Meanwhile, today, as we said, Mike, new tariffs went into effect on China. China responded with tariffs of its own on U.S. goods. What kind of impact is that likely to have on jobs and when?
So right at this moment, the trade imbroglio doesn't appear to have hurt the job market. If anything, it may be helping. Companies like U.S. Steel have added jobs in anticipation of greater demand. But there are so many wild cards involved in where exactly this is headed. If the tensions escalate and the reprisals against the U.S. escalate, then economists are going to start getting worried that it could impact jobs. Right now, though, it's interesting. If you look at Bloomberg, we compile the average estimate of economists for the unemployment rate. And the forecasts for 2019 and 2020 have actually gone down this year. They're both still below 4%. Hmm. So it's not enough yet to cause economists to increase their unemployment rate forecasts. But that said, these numbers are written in pencil, and they very well could change or be proven wrong if the trade tensions do escalate.
There are also a lot of people saying that perhaps whatever benefit came from the tax cuts could be undone by the global concern over a trade war.
Yeah. And again, in the present tense, it's probably premature to say that. But the worry is that we could wake up one morning to see that China did X, Y, and Z in response to the tariffs. You have to realize if China may run out of U.S. imports to put tariffs on if they try to keep up with some of President Trump's threats. But there are plenty of other levers they could pull, their own currency being one, their holdings of U.S. treasuries. And even earlier this week, a Chinese court ruled in a patent case against the computer chip maker Micron, basically preventing them from selling some of their products in China. So there's a lot of different levers China can pull, and there's a lot of different directions this could go. So I think that's why economists are having a very hard time putting firm estimates on the impact of the trade tensions going forward.
Mike, what does today's jobs report mean for the Federal Reserve? We're already expecting, a couple more interest rate hikes this year?
Yeah, the latest dot plot they call from the Federal Reserve, basically their projection for their benchmark interest rate is for another two this year. then anywhere between 2 to 4 next year. And I don't think today's report did anything to really move the needle on that. Again, the wage growth wasn't so strong as to spark concerns about inflation. So that path is probably still in place for now. And the market, you know, the stock market, the bond market is fairly comfortable with that path as they understand it from the Federal Reserve. So a shock in the form of, say, much higher than expected wage growth would be the type of thing that would make people change their perception of where the Fed's going.
It's Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
EPA Chief Scott Pruitt's resignation isn't only big news in Washington. It's big on social media, where thousands are weighing in on his departure yesterday. Other stories trending online include Elon Musk's ideas for ways of rescuing the Thai soccer team trapped in a cave. Also, Facebook's big snafu just revealed. The company accidentally unblocked people who its users had intentionally barred from their pages. Well, let's check in now on the week in social media with Femi Okeh of Al Jazeera English. Femi, welcome.
Thanks, Lisa. Hello.
So let's start with Scott Pruitt. President Trump tweeted yesterday saying that he has accepted the resignation of Pruitt as EPA administrator and that, quote, within the agency, Scott has done an outstanding job and I will always be thankful to him for this.
Others, what an excellent reference there via Twitter. Print that out. Put that with your resume.
Others on Twitter were at least slightly sarcastic, though. Tweeter Ian Millhiser, for example, wrote that sources say the top candidate to replace Pruitt is a literal smokestack belching mercury vapor. I think that was my favorite.
There's been a lot of reaction with a distinct lack of empathy, Lisa. Gleefully, people online are making fun of somebody who's been fired. Now, that's not very kind, but I have to say that there are more than a dozen federal investigations looking at how Scott Pruitt managed and the spending and the management of the EPA. So, Ken Klippenstein says Scott Pruitt has resigned in order to spend more time with his mattress. By your logic, Scott Pruitt is the first person to ever strip copper wiring from the White House. Lisa, tell me when you've had enough. Let me see if I can squeeze one more in here. Alex Zobrin on Twitter jokes again. Scott Pruitt casually grabs the Constitution on his way out.
Now, are the Twitter users just the caustic ones, or is there also support for Pruitt? Which there is, even beyond Donald Trump, of course.
There is some support from conservative tweeters, and they are thinking that he did a good job. He deregularized a lot of the EPA regulations, so they are patting him on his back. But I am going to say overwhelmingly, remarks like this one, this tweet from Senator Sanders says Scott Pruitt was the worst EPA administrator in the history of the agency.
Senator Sanders, somebody calling themselves that, or is that Bernie Sanders?
That is Bernie Sanders.
Moving on to a story that is gripping people all over the world, a soccer team and coach who are trapped in a cave in Chiang Rai, Thailand. Pressure is mounting to get them all out, with oxygen levels falling and the monsoon rains expected in soon. Mm. Among the tweets getting traction is one by Elon Musk, who tweeted his own solution. What is he saying?
So anytime there's a big story that involves tech or innovation, or a lot of people musing about how could we fix this? What is the solution? And if there's a lot of money involved, people often ask, what would Elon Musk do? So Mabs Max got in touch with Elon Musk. He says, hi, sir. If possible, can you assist in any way to get the 12 Thailand boys and their coach out of the cave? I have to say that Mabs Max is basically a regular Joe Schmo on Twitter. He's only got 562 followers, but tweeps love this tweet. It was liked by over 2,700 people. And Elon Musk is really active on Twitter. He likes to talk to people. So he responds back with some engineering and some tech advice. The Boring Company, that's his company, has advanced ground penetrating radar and is pretty good at digging holes. Don't know if pump rate is limited by electric power or pumps are too small. And then he goes on that I think the Thai government had probably got this pretty much under control, but he has dispatched his engineers to be at the service of the Thai government if they need them. Right. And that is just from a random tweet to Elon Musk.
And there's a lot of crowdsourcing of ideas going on there. Another story that went viral on social media this week, clothing line on sale at Walmart, including T-shirts and baby onesies that read Impeach 45, referring, of course, to Donald Trump. And that gave birth to the hashtag Boycott Walmart. And it sounds as though it worked.
People were furious. To be pedantic for a moment, though, Lisa, this clothing line was sold on Walmart's website and it's a third-party seller. So not made by Walmart directly, but they do take a commission. Let me give you an example of how mad people are. Southern Bell. Why would any store sell a shirt that says to impeach any president? So disgusting. Hashtag boycott Walmart. Walmart initially said they were reviewing their policy with this clothing line, and then they actually removed them from their website. I actually just looked just a moment ago and I typed in impeach 45 in Walmart, found nothing. But then I went to a bigger search engine, put in impeach 45 and found lots of items of clothing. So you can find them elsewhere online.
Okay, and very briefly, this week we found out that 800,000 Facebook users fell prey to a bug that ended up on blocking friends they had intentionally barred from their Facebook pages.
Mm-hmm.
The users didn't know that their friends were actually allowed to access their content after all. What's Facebook saying about this, very briefly?
They put a statement out and they called it letting people know about a blocking bug and on Messenger and Facebook. Now, if you blocked people, they now no longer can see your account. So momentarily, for about 8 days, they could have still looked at your content and checked out what you're doing, but now they are back to being blocked.
Femi OK, Al Jazeera English. Thanks, Femi.
You're always welcome. Take care, Lisa.
If you earn minimum wage in the U.S., it's likely you cannot afford to rent a two-bedroom apartment anywhere in the country. According to a recent study by the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, you'd need to make an average of $22 an hour to afford a two-bedroom. The cost of a public college education in America has more than doubled since 1996, and daycare can eat up about 30% of a parent's income. So it's no wonder that millions of Americans who are in the middle class feel as if they're on shaky economic ground. Author Alyssa Court says they are, and it wouldn't take much to put them in jeopardy.
It's just one bad thing, one hard thing. You know, you have an elderly parent that's struggling. Your child has a physical or mental problem. You have to get another degree because you've been downsized and your job has been reimagined. And then what are you going to do?
Alyssa Court knows that firsthand. She and her husband were both freelance journalists. When they were expecting their first child, they wrestled with the prospect of additional costs. That experience became the genesis for her new book called Squeezed: Why Our Families Cannot Afford America. In Squeezed, Alyssa Court speaks with adjunct college professors and Uber drivers and nannies and says we tend to think that it's just the working poor who are struggling to make it, but it's not.
I talked to a librarian in Minnesota and her husband worked in IT, and they were living in a one-bedroom apartment. Their son was sleeping in their same room with them, and they were in a great amount of educational debt, and the birth of her son had cost a lot. They owed $20,000 in hospital bills. And the term I use to describe this condition is the middle precariat.
Which means what?
It's precarious. They're living on the edge of not knowing what's going to happen next year. Adjuncts experience this. So do lawyers who have to hop from gig to gig, accountants, a whole range of different people I spoke to.
Yeah, you say that middle-class life now is 30% more expensive than it was 20 years ago. Why is that? Why the change?
Well, I think the big thing that we have to talk about here is taxes, which are relentless for middle-class population. Right now, you're being dinged under so-called tax reform for being self-employed. So these are things that one of the things is taxes. Another is income inequality itself. We have in America the largest wealth inequality gap of 200 countries, according to a global wealth report in 2015. That's the largest wealth inequality gap. And when the top 1% has so much more than even the top 10%, the middle class is financially and also mentally outclassed at every step. So, I mean, I talked to someone who was making very low six figures, and you think, oh my gosh, that's a wealthy person.
This is a guy who had a job working for Weather Underground,
right,
as a meteorologist.
Sean, but he commuted hours each day. His wife was taking care of their three children, and they were trying to keep up in this incredibly expensive part of the country, you know, Silicon Valley.
But his problems are real. As you say, it's hard to feel sorry for
somebody. It's hard to feel sorry, and I wanted to give a continuum. So I wanted to show people in the lower middle class who were kind of striving and not quite getting into the middle class, and also people who we would say, oh, they're fine, they're doing fine. What are they moaning about? They're kvetching, you know. But I wanted to show that there is a kind of suffering for them, too.
And on the other end, you have what you call extreme daycare, and you profile someone named Dolores Hogan, who runs Dees Tots Childcare in New Rochelle, New York. This is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for people who work shifts all around the clock and have to drop off their kids at pretty much any time of day. You spent time there. You kind of embedded at Dees Tots Childcare. What did you see?
I saw these two incredibly caring people who are married who run a 24-hour daycare. I call it extreme daycare because the parents would drop them off, the kids off at 7 in the morning, they might pick them up at 10 at night, and they might put them in daycare for a couple hours and then spend time with them and then drop them off again because they were working multiple jobs, which is a condition that many people have to do right now to survive.
Can you read part of that chapter?
Oh, absolutely.
This is, you're talking about the Hogans, an African-American couple that runs this daycare center.
So this was at the 24-hour daycare, which was a really warm, loving place. But, you know, the kids were, they missed their parents. So on one of my visits, giant puffy pencils and teddy bear balloons were hanging from the front fence, and kids were jumping on a bouncy house, giving the place a touch of the carnival. At twilight, two children helped Dolores water her cucumber and melon plants while keeping their eyes out for plundering raccoons. I'm going to move on for a later section. These 24-hour kids seemed all right, for now, at least, and unusually self-sufficient. One night, Diana, Marisol's 8-year-old daughter, showed me how to perfectly squeeze toothpaste out of a tube, like in a commercial. Her 4-year-old sister, Yvette, brushed her own teeth without being asked. I saw a little of the sorrow or loneliness one might expect to see in these kids, though I did catch ripples of uncertainty and need. A few of the children did seem parentified in the useful but awkward psychology parlance. They seemed wise beyond their years, having been forced to grow up and parent themselves earlier than we might wish.
Many of the people that you profile in the book are, like the Hogans, care workers, daycare directors, nannies, teachers, professors, nurses. And you argue that these professions, the caring professions, are especially poorly paid because, as you say, care work is devalued and even disdained. What is the stigma around these professions?
I think there's a contempt for care work and caregiving in this country that seeps into how we think about mothers, professional workers who are mothers. A survey showed that people would offer $11,000 less to a mother than to a childless woman, and obviously much more to a man. And I think it's part of our discomfort with vulnerability and need and people whose work has a kind of an emotional element.
Is that a particularly American characteristic?
I think so. I mean, I'm sure there's other places that would echo that, and I don't want to make a broad estimate. But if you look at the daycare offerings of many other countries.
In terms of subsidies.
They're so much higher, from Scandinavia to Canada.
Like what? How does it work there?
In Quebec, for instance, maternity and paternity leave insurance gives a parent up to 75% of his or her salary and covers up to 15 or 18 continuous weeks for the mother. You know, in Denmark, mothers get 4 weeks of paid pregnancy leave before their child is born. And in America, 13 to 14% of jobs have paid family leave.
How much do they pay in Canada for daycare?
$7 to $20 a day in Quebec, in Montreal.
A day?
Yeah.
Not just an hour, but a day.
And then you think about American daycare facilities where, you know, on the low end, it's like $10,000 to $14,000. And on the high end, it can be like $30,000 a year.
So in the larger picture, there's changing the mindset as we look towards solutions to these problems. This is, you know, a series of systemic problems. Globalization gets into it. Roboticization gets into it. And the stripping of jobs. You go into that in the book. What are the solutions that you came across?
Things like universal pre-K, which has been flourishing in New York City, would be great across the board, across this country. And they're starting 3K for 3-year-olds. One of the architects of it was telling me how parents who enrolled their kids in universal pre-K felt a psychological well-being having their kids there for the day. It wasn't just financial. It was in a public school setting, not in an informal daycare, for instance. And then things like improved maternity leave and pregnancy leave. But, you know, whenever I say these things, there's always a naysayer who will say, how is this possible? And I say, look at Me Too. Look at gay marriage. Gosh, look at Trump being voted in. For me, this is not a good thing. But and these are all huge shifts in this country that seem to happen almost overnight. But there's been a real uprising around them that leads to them happening. So I feel like, who knows, we could decide in the next few years, we're just going to adopt a different level of maternity leave.
And what about the universal basic income?
Right. So universal basic income is a set amount of money that would be given to each citizen. And it's being piloted in places like Stockton, California and Ontario. And it's like $12,000 per person or $20,000 per family, roughly. Richard Nixon argued for it in 1969. And in the 1970s, it was referred to as income maintenance, where citizens in certain cities like Gary, Indiana and Seattle, Washington were given a certain amount. Alaska has paid residents, given something resembling UBI, $1,000 to $1,500 each. I mean, that seems a little low, but it's not unprecedented. It's not entirely pie in the sky. And I was just thinking what that would have done for someone like some of these adjuncts I had spoken to. So these are some of the solutions in my book. I mean, I have others that are more personal. You know, I hate to tell people to tend their own gardens, but let's say we are thrown back on ourselves. What can we do? Well, we can organize as people are doing around adjuncts right now, for instance, adjunct professors. There's a group called something like Tenure for the Social Good that's trying to raise awareness and money for adjunct labor. Why are they making $3,000 a class? Why is this the majority of professors in universities? And then there's other kinds of white-collar organizing. I include my own nonprofit economic hardship reporting project. We're giving support to journalists, including low-income journalists. We raise money for newspapers after their union busting and other kinds of malicious firings, and we created funds for laid-off journalists, and we're planning to create more. So there are things like that that give me hope. And then finally, we can vote for people with family-friendly policies. And locally, it's also extremely important. That's where a lot of these, say, universal pre-K would be local municipal decisions.
The book is called Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Author Alyssa Quart is our guest. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Lisa.
As President Trump continues to mull over his short list of Supreme Court candidates, special interest groups on both sides have taken to the airwaves to plead their cases. Here's an ad currently running on national cable channels.
President Trump has proven that he wants the best of the best on the Supreme Court. He appointed Justice Neil Gorsuch, a fair and independent justice committed to the Constitution. Now there's another opening, a chance to appoint another great justice. Like they did before, extremists will lie and attack the nominee. But don't be fooled.
Joining us now to help sort through the air wars is Here and Now media analyst John Carroll. Hi, John.
Hello, Jeremy.
And I've seen that ad we just played. Tell us about what we just heard.
Right. So that's an ad from a conservative group called the Judicial Crisis Network. Mm-hmm. And they're reportedly running about $1 million buy on national cable and some digital platforms. This is a group that's been very active around Supreme Court nominations. They said they spent about $7 million trying to block Merrick Garland and also said that they spent $10 million promoting Neil Gorsuch. So they're going to be a player here.
Are there other conservative groups in the mix?
Yeah, there's one called One Nation, another nonprofit. It's associated with Mitch McConnell. They've been running a $100,000 digital campaign. The Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, anti-abortion group Susan B. Anthony Fund say they'll be active as well, sometimes in other areas.
And the liberal interest groups are also targeting, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. A lot of their spots are running in Alaska and Maine, targeting Senators Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins. Here's an ad from a group called Protect Our Care that's been running this week.
This is an emergency. President Trump has already gone to court to overturn health care protections for people with pre-existing conditions. 130 million Americans have pre-existing conditions like cancer, diabetes, and asthma. Now, Trump and Mitch McConnell have a plan to install a Supreme Court justice who will overturn those protections. Who would take
so that's one of the liberal ads. Obamacare and Roe v. Wade seem to be the two issues that liberal groups want to emphasize.
Right. There's another nonprofit called Demand Justice that just launched what it says will be a five $5 million ad campaign, also targeted at Maine and Alaska. And Roe v. Wade and Obamacare, especially pre-existing conditions of protection, are issues that are especially important to Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins. So they're hoping that that will put some pressure on them to vote against whatever candidate might come up. They don't know what candidate's going to be there, but they figure these two issues are good ones to latch onto.
Do we know who's putting up all this money that these groups are spending?
It's really hard to tell because these are all 501c4s, which are nonprofit groups known as social welfare groups, and they don't have to disclose their donors. So there's some indication that the Judicial Crisis Network has some connections to the industrialist billionaire Koch brothers. There is some indication that Demand Justice is associated with some former Obama and Clinton campaign operatives, but nobody really knows exactly who's giving exactly how much.
Do you think these ads make a difference?
I don't think they make a difference. I think it's sort of a media slap fight that they get involved in. Mm-hmm. And I think in the end, it'll probably be a wash. But we're going to see a lot more of them once the nominee is announced on Monday.
That's John Carroll, Here and Now media analyst and a journalism professor at Boston University. John, thank you.
Thank you.
The big news in basketball this week is that LeBron James is leaving the Cleveland Cavaliers to head to Los Angeles to play for the Lakers. As James leaves, he's set to open a new public school sponsored by the LeBron James Family Foundation in his hometown of Akron. In an editorial on Tuesday, the Los Angeles Times said it hoped James would expand his commitment to helping kids in Ohio to include disadvantaged youths in L.A. Many professional athletes devote some of their time to service and philanthropy. Ray Allen is one of the greatest basketball shooters in NBA history, and since retiring from the NBA in 2014, he has dedicated much of his time to learning about the Holocaust and making sure others don't forget what happened. Gary Wallach of NPR's Only a Game has our story.
Ray Allen first learned about the Holocaust when he was in middle school.
We read Anne Frank's diary. I didn't know if it was just a story that people told. I didn't realize it was an actual event until I watched Schindler's List in 1993.
Was ist das? Ist das Bach? Nein. Ist das Bach?
Nein, Mozart.
Mozart? Ja.
When Schindler's List opened in movie theaters, Ray Allen was a rising star at the University of Connecticut. The Milwaukee Bucks chose him in the 1996 NBA draft. While the Bucks were on an East Coast road trip in 1998, team owner Herb Cole invited Allen to join him on a tour of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C.
And it was scary. The room with the hair, the room with the shoes, it was human. You've seen the real human side of it. This wasn't just a museum of wax figures or ideas. It was something that belonged to real people. They were annihilated.
Soon, Ray Allen would encourage his teammates to join him on tours of the Holocaust Museum whenever the Bucks were in Washington to play the Wizards. When he was traded to the Seattle Supersonics and later to the Boston Celtics, he did the same.
I met him almost 10 years ago when he brought the Boston Celtics to the museum.
Andres Abril is with the U.S. Holocaust Museum. What he remembers most about Ray Allen is his quiet intensity.
He doesn't say a lot. He wanted his teammates to have an experience that was meaningful for them, and so I think he knew that letting it happen was the way to do it.
The Celtics would go on to win the 2008 NBA title. By this time, Allen had established himself as one of the greatest shooters of all time. He picked up another title with the Miami Heat and retired from basketball in 2014. That meant more time for family and for charity work, and for playing an occasional round of golf with President Obama, who appointed Allen to the United States Holocaust Memorial Council in 2016. Allen wanted to learn about the Holocaust in depth and up close.
To see and to feel what these people went through, to put my feet on those grounds.
It was time for a trip to Poland.
The idea was my idea.
That's Rabbi Simon Taylor. He hadn't even known who Ray Allen was until they met at a fundraiser. But after he heard Allen speak about the Holocaust, Taylor told him,
"You have to go to Poland and learn more and see for yourself."
Taylor had been to Poland several times. His family on his paternal grandfather's side had lived there before the war. Most of them were murdered in the Holocaust. On April 30th, 2017, Taylor, Ray Allen, and two of his friends left for Poland. They planned a three-day trip, and Allen wanted to see all he could. They began at Warsaw ghetto sites. They met nuns at a nearby monastery where hundreds of Jews had been saved from the Nazis. And then...
Ray got to meet an actual Holocaust survivor.
Moshe Tirosh is the last survivor of the Warsaw Zoo. As a six-year-old boy, Tirosh and his sister were hidden for weeks in the basement of zookeepers Jan and Antonina Zabinski, who saved hundreds of Jews during the Nazi occupation.
And Moshe got to show Ray all around the zoo, the house, exactly where he hid, the crazy conditions, and explained to him the really gruesome stories of things that he saw and what he went through to survive. To watch Ray revere this Holocaust survivor as him being the hero and to eat up every word that he had to say, reliving his memories from hiding in the zoo, it was very special.
The next day, the group headed to Auschwitz, where over a million Jews were murdered.
And it was freezing. I was dressed from top to bottom, warm, and I could only imagine what the people in the camps felt like, wearing only pajamas and some of them with no shoes and no socks. And people slept on straw, and if you slept on the bottom bunk, you were sleeping on the ground. There's nowhere that you can hide. You stripped of any humanity, you could tell how it just would break everybody down.
Ray came out of Auschwitz very moved and felt a connection to Auschwitz and the Holocaust that he never had before, however much he had read and however many museums he'd been to.
I think it's a trip that every person should make.
But the trip wasn't over yet. Rabbi Simon Taylor.
There was a family from the small town that were excavating to extend their house. And it turned out that part of the foundation of their house was built using Jewish tombstones.
During World War II, Jewish headstones were stolen and used as construction materials. Allen and Taylor met up with a group of descendants of Holocaust survivors who rescue the desecrated stones.
We went and studied the tombstones to see, who do these tombstones belong to? What type of people? What age? Where do they come from? And we went straight to the Jewish cemetery, where I actually had the privilege to lead the ceremony, where we returned the Jewish tombstones to a Jewish cemetery where they belong. And the family that returned them felt like they had done the right thing. Ray felt like he'd done a great thing. And of course, me being the rabbi, was delighted to have these tombstones where they belong in the Jewish cemetery.
So we did that, and then we went to another home where a family actually hid six Jews in their kitchen floor.
That was in the small Polish town of Czepolów. At the beginning of the Nazi occupation, a Polish family of 10 lived in that house.
A very, very modest, small cottage that still stands. It has a floorboard in the kitchen that you can remove and see a very dark, cramped basement.
And we actually went down into the hole, and the walls were wet. They were sweating down there. It was cold down there. Somebody in the town told the Nazis that they were hiding a Jewish family down there, and the Nazis came over there.
The Nazis didn't find any Jews hiding in the house, but they punished the family with a death sentence. 10 family members lived in the house, but one of their little boys wasn't home. The Nazis had to make their quota of 10, so they took another little boy from the house next door.
They killed everybody in the house, and the little boy who wasn't present, he came home to learn that everybody was executed in his barn.
That little boy grew up and raised a family of his own. Ray Allen and the delegation met his grandson, who now lives in the house. Ray wanted to share that experience in Poland with his friends and family. He Snapchatted at each stop during his 3 days there. That opened him up to some criticism.
Ray was getting a lot of pushback from friends and a lot of people on social media, saying, Ray, why is this such a big priority for you? You're a black man who's not Jewish. Each person that he received a message from on social media and each person he got a call from, he took on that battle to tell them why they were wrong and why this is absolutely what he should be doing and why everybody needs to be learning about the Holocaust.
After returning home, Allen wrote an essay for the Players Tribune. In it, he said, I didn't go to Poland as a black person, a white person, a Christian person, or a Jewish person. I went as a human being. But as a black man, he sees a connection to the Holocaust.
looking at this country and look at the tragedies that have taken place in this country, in the history of this country, for black people, we're still fighting for acceptance, still fighting for equality. And I just ask that people have empathy. Even a successful black man in this country, I still get treated unfairly. There's racism towards me every single day.
Ray Allen says he'll continue to refute those who deny and distort the Holocaust, and he wants to educate more children about it. Andres Abril says Allen is the right man for the job.
I think he brings a power of a different voice. He brings a legitimizing perspective.
Allen also wants to go to Israel and back to Poland to learn even more about the Holocaust. And he wants to visit Robben Island in South Africa, where Nelson Mandela was imprisoned for 18 years.
You know, we learn what we need to do to move forward so we can make sure that certain things don't happen in this world ever again.
For Here and Now, I'm Gary Wallach.
Today, Scotland is marking a grim anniversary.
Reports are coming in of an explosion on board an oil rig platform in the North Sea. The explosion happened on the Piper Alpha platform, which is owned by the Occidental Company and operates 120 miles northeast of Aberdeen. Rescue helicopters have been sent from Shetland and Aberdeen, but so far there are no reports of casualties.
That last line is chilling from the BBC report of July 6, 1988. The eventual death toll was 167. 61 men survived. The BBC's Rebecca Curran is in Aberdeen, Scotland. Rebecca, here in the United States, we remember the Deepwater Horizon accident in 2010 off the coast of Louisiana. 11 workers died then. The accident off Scotland's coast 30 years ago today was even more serious. What happened on the Piper Alpha platform?
Yes, absolutely. As you mentioned there, the death toll was astonishing. 167 men died. What happened on the day? I mean, it was about 9:45 at night on the Piper Alpha. One of two pumps located under the main body of the platform stopped working. Failure to restart a pump within 30 minutes would have meant shutting down the entire platform, which at that point accounted for about 10% of all North Sea oil and gas production. So to prevent a really costly shutdown, the second pump was started, but it was also faulty. Now, the control room was unaware that earlier maintenance work on that pump had not been completed, and so gas started to leak and then exploded. At 9:20 that night, a series of explosions followed as pipelines linking Piper Alpha to two other platforms in the North Sea ruptured and burst. Now, some of the crew jumped from the rig and they managed to survive, but most remained in the accommodation block waiting to be rescued. Shortly after, the platform collapsed into the sea, and in the space of 2 hours, 167 men lost their lives. It remains the world's worst offshore disaster. Amazingly, those 61 men survived, but the platform was completely destroyed, and it took almost 3 weeks for the fire to be brought under control.
One of the doctors who was part of the medical team sent from Aberdeen was Alastair Madison. He spoke to the BBC about the challenges that the men who survived the initial explosion faced.
There was a small group of men who sought refuge in a relatively unscathed part of the rig. They described to me that the air there was fresher, it was cooler. They remained there for some time. A second explosion occurred, and they decided then to evacuate. One of the problems that faced them was that they could not find an area of sea that was not on fire to jump into. But eventually one did manage to locate an area of sea that they thought they could safely jump into. And two of them went into this area of sea, and they more or less assisted each other to the boat.
So these men eventually, as he said, made it to the rescue boat. They were the lucky ones. Many must have been from Aberdeen. How is the tragedy resonating there today? How's the anniversary being marked?
Well, there's a memorial service planned for tonight. As you say, I mean, Aberdeen was extremely touched by this disaster. I'll tell you a little bit about the plans that are happening. Where I'm standing just now, actually, I'm in the Piper Alpha Memorial Garden. It's a beautiful day here. The sun is shining and the Rose Garden is in full bloom, and tonight hundreds of people are expected to turn up here to honour the men who died. The main feature of this memorial garden is a statue. It was specially commissioned after the disaster. It's of three oil workers set in bronze, and beneath them the names of every man who died that night. And it's a focal point not only for the family and friends of those who died, but also survivors and this city as a whole, which has never forgotten the tragedy. It's a place here of quiet contemplation, reflection and remembrance. And that indeed is what will be happening tonight as people gather here to mark the 30th anniversary.
Rebecca, are any of those who survived still alive?
Yes, absolutely. And some of those survivors will be coming here tonight. They have shared their memories over the years. Many of them say that, you know, it's extremely important to keep talking about the disaster and what happened, because, of course, what followed it was a huge inquiry and the safety measures that were introduced following Piper Alpha remain in place today. And many of the survivors feel that it's important to keep the conversation going and make sure people remember exactly what can happen if and when things go wrong. So many of the survivors will come here today. They will hear the names of the 167 men who died being read out. They will also take part in a one-minute silence. As I say, this service giving them all an opportunity to come back together and to make sure that no one forgets those who died and the shocking events of that night.
BBC's Rebecca Curran speaking with us from Aberdeen, Scotland. Thank you very much, Rebecca.
Thank you very much for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.